Welcome to Only Murders in My Mind, a Random Thought production. Hi, I'm Carol Bissett, a crime writer, and I invite you with my co-presenters, Liz Hedgecock and Mike Jackson, each week to our conversations on all things murderous. Hello and welcome to episode 9 of Only Murders in My Mind with my two co-presenters, Liz Hedgecock and Mike Jackson. Hello, both.
Hello, Carol.
Hi, Carol.
How you both been?
Fine, thank you. I'm still a little bit, you know,
shaken about last time
with all those psychological thrillers. I've not been sleeping well since then.
Oh, well, I've been to Birmingham, have a lovely time chatting with my friend Paula about serious stuff.
So, yes.
Yes, lots of art galleries. Now I have to do all the things I didn't do because I was in Birmingham.
Well, I mean, were you doing any research or was it purely for fun?
A bit of both, really, but you can tell we're both public sector.
Yeah.
Well, at least in my case, ex-public sector, because both of us brought post-it notes to do the plotting. But Paula wins on that because she also bought a paper tablecloth to do the plotting on. So, yes.
Why not?
There you go. So, yes, we are happy as Larry, sticking our post-it notes here, there and everywhere.
Yeah, because I know when Liz and Paula get together for fun, they usually end up seeing something that sparks an idea for a book or a story, because they both write individual books, but as I say, they get together and co-write.
When they met, it was Moida. Like heart to heart.
Yeah. So thank you for listening. We say this each week. We really do appreciate the fact that you're taking the time to listen. We hope you're enjoying what you're hearing. Please let us know if there's anything you'd like us to a topic you'd like us to talk about, or if there's got any questions, we'll do our best between the three of us to answer it. So you like, subscribe, tell your friends about us, and we really appreciate it. This week we're going to talk about police procedural, what goes into a book that makes it authentic or believable when it comes to what the police actually do in real life. And I suppose it's a bit of poetic license a lot of the time when you're writing books, but you don't want to make a complete idiot of yourself. You want to try and get, you know, the basics right at the very least. Some of the people that I would say use that, they make sure that they've got that side of their stories right. Anne Cleves, mm-hmm. you know, yeah. Peter James, Val McDermott, Ian Rankin. We were just talking about the Rebus books. Tuesday Murder Club. No, Tuesday Club Murders. Agatha Christie. Does that make any sense?
Mm. New one on me.
No. Well, it must be sorry, Mike. Right. I'm kicking my co-presenter under the table.
He hasn't even done anything yet. No.
Give me time.
Again, I've Googled this, folks, and that could be completely wrong. So we'll see. But yeah, a lot of the things you see on television now that have got the police doing, solving crimes, you know, we'll see the yellow tape going round with do not cross. And do you know what? It doesn't work. You can actually duck under it. It's not very good at all to stop people going into places. My Warrant Detective books, I try and use police procedural events in those, and I do quite a lot of research. I also have friends who are ex-police officers, and I usually ask them to cast their eye over it to see whether I've made any errors. Mm-hmm. But again, I do take a big chunk of poetic license. Do any books jump into your mind? And I know we were just talking about it before we started recording. You were saying the Rebus books. Do you think they come into that?
Difficult call, isn't it?
Because I've read
Rebus is definitely a police officer. Yeah. You can't argue with that. Yeah. But yeah, they don't feel to me to have like lots of the things you'd expect necessarily.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, he feels much more of a lone wolf.
He is, isn't he? He goes off and does it. He often gets into trouble.
Yeah, whereas with police procedural, I suppose I'm expecting an ensemble.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's like in your books, Carol, where you have the various people and the hierarchy and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And you don't really feel that with the Rebus books.
No. I find that I have read some books before where it's obvious that somebody, that the writer has done some excellent research because they're throwing it all in.
Is it too much?
And it's too much. You know, if I'm reading a murder story and there's a forensic report, I just need the bare bones of that. I don't need all the nitty-gritty about the poison that was used, that came from this, that came from that, that has been studied by scientists for the last 30 years and it's made up of this chemical and that. By that time, I've lost the will to live. And yet at the same time, I don't know if anybody's noticed this, but when I watch Vera, you get a lot of police procedures in that. So the, when they're in the room and they've got the whiteboard there with all the names and the photos on, Vera will turn around and say to one of the main characters, have you followed up that forensic, or have you followed up the... I'm doing it, boss. And at the same time, there's about four or five people wandering around, extras, who aren't doing anything. And she never asked them to do anything.
She's got a favourite, hasn't she?
She's got two or three main characters who have to do everything.
Yeah. Well, that's probably because they've not been paid enough to get online. That'll be what it is. Well, she's probably had instructions, don't call on them.
Extras in the background that don't get paid for to talk,
Poor things.
I'm just trying to think. When you get to things like, what was the one where the... Call of Duty? No.
Line of Duty?
Thank you. Line of Duty. There used to be a lot of...
Isn't Call of Duty where you shoot a lot of people?
I think that's a game, isn't it?
Yeah, I believe so. Yes.
Sorry about getting mixed up, but, you know, my son's often on these games.
I'll go home and ask a teenager.
Yeah. Was Line of Duty the one where the police were investigating themselves?
Yes. Yeah.
Isn't that the one with Jesus, Mary, Joseph and the wee donkey?
And the donkey.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, no, they weren't actually in it, but it was that was said quite a lot.
That would have been quite a strange procedure, wouldn't it?
Because I bought that mug for my son-in-law with that quote on it because it used to make him chuckle. Mm. I'm just trying to think about other things. I mean, I suppose now we think about forensics because that tends to, the series where they've got forensics or the books where they've got forensics, Rosalie and Isles. I don't know if you've ever... I mean, it's an American series, but there's a whole ton of books.
Right. Yes.
Which I've read most of them, and there's, of course, that...
Would you recommend?
I think probably the books are better than the TV series. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I quite enjoyed them. Mm. But the reason I got them was because she actually guested on one of the last episodes of the series. Isles, the pathologist, was had written a crime book, and she'd gone to a crime convention, and the author was going, oh, it's quite a good book. You don't want to let people put you off. And I'm going, I'm sure she's the person that actually writes this series. And she was. So she did a little cameo role.
Oh, that's sweet.
Yeah.
Isn't it strange, though, because in previous episodes, we've been talking a lot about Agatha Christie, and Sherlock Holmes has got mentioned a few times. And in those stories, police procedures just hardly come into it, do they? It's Miss Marple or Hercule or Sherlock himself who does all the solving through observation mainly.
Yeah. Well, that's, I suppose you class those as, you know, amateur sleuth or...
Yes, yeah. But you don't get much in the way of forensics or anything like that. You know, he was either hit by a hammer or he wasn't, or he was poisoned.
Well, I mean, to be fair, I mean, forensics was probably in its infancy when Sherlock was doing it. I mean, he was probably as close as you got to any kind of scientific approach.
That's true.
What with his, you know, analysis of like the London clays for footprints and stuff like that.
But it doesn't make those stories any less worth reading today because there aren't any forensics and what have you.
I think some writers avoid it going into it too deep because, as you said, it can tie the science side of it can absolutely tie you up in knots. You know, but and Alec Jeffries, he discovered DNA in 1985. Now, do we always expect every crime that goes to court to have DNA evidence these days?
Ooh,
I suppose if it's a serious crime, we're looking for it. In 1988, his DNA science got Colin Pitchfork prosecuted and found guilty of the murder of two teenagers. But it was a massive undertaking because the DNA whole sequencing thing was in its infancy.
Yes.
They had to go around the village where these girls had been murdered and asking volunteers to give their DNA, male volunteers, and took hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of swabs. Mm. So it was the old looking for a needle in a haystack sort of thing. But it has changed the face of crime, DNA sequencing.
I mean, I suppose with anything, there's going to be a payoff, isn't there, around the seriousness of the crime, the amount of time and expense and person hours that are going to be taken up, and the likelihood that you will actually get something.
Yeah.
So I guess it's those three things in play.
I think it's also, isn't it, the time element of this, as you say, with the DNA, and when you watch television programs where they must spend days and days looking at video footage. Real crime, real policing is not something that happens overnight. It's something that's lots of man hours, women hours, and lots of time spent on it. As a reader, you don't want to know about that. You just want to know who did it.
Mm. I mean, fingertip search, where the police are all in a row and they're going along and they're sometimes literally down on their hands and knees, going door to door. Like you say, looking at film that's been captured, phoning people, going to interview people. It's a mammoth task.
And doesn't make for good writing.
No, because that side of it's... I mean, if you're making a documentary about something that's really happened, you can sort of just say, over the next 5 months they did this and jump to an interesting bit. But no, big people. Unless you're interested in the whole thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I suppose that's the thing, though. When you're writing a book, you can kind of touch on it and then go away again and do something else. And then maybe come back to, how's the thing? Et cetera.
Well, a scientist called James Marsh, who was French, he was from Lyon. He found a test for arsenic, and it was the poison of choice. And we're going back now to around 1910. James Marsh found this test for arsenic, and the police took a man to court who'd been charged with poisoning his wife, and he'd proven that it was arsenic in the cup, but by the time they got to court, it had all just degraded. So what he did then was he went and actually found a test that was much more sensitive, and they still use it today for arsenic. I don't think they use it for any other poisons. No, the person I'm thinking of is Edward Locarn, and he opened the first crime investigation lab in 1910 in Lyon, and he's the one that said every contact leaves a trace. And that is often used. You'll hear it quoted in...
That is a fantastic line.
It is, isn't it? Yeah.
We're all storing that one up.
Yes. That's good enough for a title for a book, isn't it?
It is,
Every contact leaves a trace. So,
and if any of our readers want to write a short story...
Every contact leaves a trace.
With that as the title. We'd be happy to hear them.
Yes. I'm now thinking of your lavatory portal story. I mean, every contact would leave a trace. How is that going, Mike?
This is my novella you're talking about, isn't it? You know, it's making progress. I've actually progressed slightly. For anybody who doesn't know, you need to go back to episode 1 when I got bullied, episode 7 where I gave a progress report on my novella, which involved loos in the Lost Cafe, which were portals to other worlds. And as for progress, Liz, I have now almost got chapter 1 in my head, where Adam, the main character, has a conversation with a woman who has come to use the portal because she is from another world. I can't tell you her name, because if I told you her name, it's so long it would take a year to read it out. And she can't show her real self because it would frighten Adam. So she has to take on this identity of a human. And then she rushes off to the loo, so Adam thinks. But when he goes to check a bit later, because, of course, they are unisex loos.
Unisex loos, yes.
Okay, yes.
He finds her sort of talking to herself, and then everything goes quiet. He wonders if there's a problem. He goes in and she's disappeared. As she said she would, because that's her way to get back to her world.
Right.
My two friends are now looking extremely bemused.
No, this is fine.
Not a police procedure in sight.
Given some of the stuff I've perpetrated, that all seems perfectly normal to me. Yeah.
So all I can say is watch this space.
Anyway, back to the police.
Meanwhile, it's interesting because things like what makes me interested is when forensics come up that are really unusual, and it proves, as you say, it proves a case. Things like identical twins have the same DNA? So what do you think? Do they?
No.
Right answer.
Thank you.
It's very, well done, very, man. Very similar, but it's not the same. We all have completely different fingerprints. We've known that for a long time. Mm-hmm. And now they can...
When does fingerprint science date from? Is that early 20th century?
I think fingerprints came in...
goes back quite a long time.
Yeah, around 1910, 1920, yeah. Something like that.
I think they had a sort of a vague idea in the Victorian period, yes. But it wasn't systematic.
No. I think it was, you'd have to get a really good set of fingerprints to be able to compare them.
And the thing is, without some kind of database, then, I mean, what are you going to do with them when you've got them?
It's scuppered, really. And now they know that everybody's ears are different.
Yes.
No two people have the same ears.
Yes.
Now,
isn't that something you talked about? Because you're a super recognizer.
I'm a super recognizer. Yes. I recognize people. I'm doing research with a couple of universities, one in Australia and one in this country. And one of the ways I got a really high score on one of them was because I looked at the people's ears, because they do change them ever so slightly. They're appears to put glasses on them, and you know, the hair might be slightly darker and all this sort of thing. But a couple of them, I was like, oh. At the same ears, exactly the same person, sort of thing.
What you'll notice about our podcast is that we have a knack of going off on tangents. So I'm about to take us off on a tangent. You may also know, if you're a regular listener, that I'm quite interested in AI. And I was having a conversation with a friend of mine the other day who was saying that he has a terrible memory, especially when it comes to people's names.
Mm-hmm.
And he said he can recognise people, but for the life of him, can never remember the name. And he said it's nothing to do with his age. He's always been like that. And I was saying that I read somewhere recently that they're very close to having glasses, AI glasses, artificially intelligent glasses, which will actually recognize the person that you're talking to. And on the lens of your glasses, it will be their name, their birthday, you know, how long you've known them, where you first met them. All that sort of thing. So people with bad memories like mine will have no problem in the past, in the future rather, just have the glasses on and be able to see somebody and have all the information they need about that person.
And I think, wow, he remembered me after all this.
Yes.
Time.
That's good, because I won't have to keep going, you know, so-and-so to my husband. Yeah.
But there's one interesting fact about DNA. If somebody's had a bone marrow transplant, they'll have two sets of DNA.
Oh, right.
So that's really interesting. And I saw that in a programme. It was fiction, but it didn't sort of, you're going, this can't be right. Mm. You know, this person's dead, but you've got their DNA. And the person had previously been a bone marrow donor too.
Okay.
To the person that they'd checked.
So Carol, you I know you do a lot of research with regard to police procedures. Which comes first? Do you think about or do that research about police procedures, which gives you an idea for the story? Or do you have the story first and then you want to go and check that you've got your procedures right?
It's the story. And then I sort of try to put myself in the mindset of, right, so this has happened in this garage. What would the police now do? What would they look for? And there's all the basic stuff, you know, about cordoning and the outer cordons and looking for footprints and, you know, they all get gowned up. But then you have to, as I say, dig a bit deeper and try and find out some of the things that you probably wouldn't know. Mm.
Mm-hmm.
And it can get really, I can go down a rabbit hole really.
I bet you can.
You know, because anything to do with science and medicine, because I was a nurse, I find it really fascinating. I mean, one of the things that they used to use for evidence was blood groups.
Mm-hmm.
But that isn't very good because most people are blood group O positive, you know. So there's an awful lot of people. The only time it would work is if somebody had a rare blood group going back and into the past sort of thing. But yes, there's been a lot of... I remember watching a programme once and somebody was actually taking pictures. This is going back to Victorian time, taking pictures of people's ears.
Okay.
Because he was absolutely convinced that everybody had
different ears,
you know. But he was just doing research. Everybody that passed through his lab, he was going, can I take a picture of your ear? And there's all this flashing going on like you get with the old...
Well, mind you, the Victorians did all sorts of things. Like, you know, they'd take pictures of faces and they'd be like, oh, look at the criminal type with their low brow or whatever it is.
Yeah, measure the head circumference with those caliper things. To see what they feel, the cranium, to see if they had any odd bumps and things like that.
Yes.
And that's quite scary because, I mean, it's certainly during... the Second World War. It's something the Nazis did a lot of, in sort of terms of measuring people to see if they were Jewish or Jewish tendencies.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to read a little bit out of my second Warranted Detective book, which I hope goes to show the sort of pathology that we're looking at. Now, this one is called The Vein Killer, and Vein is V-E-I-N. Start off with my favourite pathologist, who is Dr. John Barron. Dr. John Barron stood up and looked at the scene about him from his 6 foot, 4 inch perspective. He sighed, tired and disillusioned about life, or to be more accurate, death. John wondered if he should change his career or at least take a break from it. On the floor of the derelict old pub were two bodies of two young adults locked in each other's arms, for all the world as if they were just asleep. It might have been almost romantic if not for the blowflies invading their cavities, so they had been dead for at least 2 days.
Oh, Carol.
just another drug-related death, maybe. There was certainly enough drug paraphernalia scattered around the floor, and the female still had the tourniquet around her arm, which was now a slightly deeper shade of grey than the rest of her exposed tissue. But Socko buzzed around like the flies on the bodies. John had his doubts. It just didn't feel right.
It did.
Yes, so what he was looking at there was the infestation of larvae and bugs, etc., because they all...
Is that something that would take a certain amount of time?
Yeah, they all develop at certain... rates, depending on the temperature where the bodies would have been found and the body, you know, the body temperature sort of. So if they were out somewhere cold, it would slow everything down.
Yes.
You know, and the best way to get a body temperature these days is by sticking a thermometer into the liver, directly into the liver that's on a bit of a spike.
Oh, okay.
And you can push it straight into the liver and you get a core temperature that's more accurate than the way they normally do it.
Right, okay.
So
I shall remember that for future reference.
So that was his first thoughts that you know, that these two people, who it would seem on the surface, maybe suicide, murder, or maybe just two people who decided to commit suicide, or was it just a drugs overdose that, you know, they got it completely wrong when they took the drugs. Mm-hmm. You'll have to read the book to find out.
Indeed.
Mike, you've got something there?
I have, but because I only write short stories, I never have any need for any sort of forensic autopsy.
They've not got time to get there, have they?
They've not got time to get there. They're either dead or they're not.
Or they're heading for the loo. Yeah.
But what I was interested in doing, because I knew we were talking about this today, was to... talk to ChatGPT, which is AI, and I do this a lot. And I wondered what would happen if I asked ChatGPT to give me an autopsy report or scene of the crime. So what I said to them was, Humpty Dumpty didn't fall, he was murdered. Could you give me an autopsy report?
Okay.
And this is what I got. So it starts off with an autopsy number, date of the autopsy of the pathologist, a Dr. Goose.
Nice.
External examination. The remains of Humpty Dumpty were fragmented, consistent with a significant height fall. A through-and-through gunshot wound was identified in one of the larger fragments. The entry wound was located in the upper segment and the exit wound was on the opposite side. Internal examination. Due to the nature of the victim's physiology, traditional internal examination was not feasible. However, the trajectory of the bullet was established through alignment of the entry and exit wounds, suggesting that the victim was facing towards the shooter at the time of the incident. Cause of death. The cause of death is determined to be a combination of the gunshot wound and subsequent trauma from the fall. And then it goes on to talk a ballistic report about the shell casings, DNA analysis.
Is that the shell of the gun or the shell of Humpty?
The shell of the gun. And the conclusion, the ballistic evidence suggests that the shots were fired from a distance with a .22 caliber handgun. The absence of gunpowder residue on Mr. Dumpty's remains further support the theory of a long-range shooting. Fingerprint and DNA analysis are pending and will be crucial in identifying the perpetrator.
Yes.
It was quite detailed.
It was, wasn't it?
And what struck me, and what's more...
What I'm curious is about, I mean, if Humpty Dumpty has fallen off the wall and there's been a gunshot, I would assume that Humpty Dumpty was in fragments. So I don't see how you would be able to work out the trajectory of the entry and the exit wound unless you put him all back together again.
Which they try and do.
Yes.
They try and do, yeah.
I think he died of shell shock.
Sorry about that.
But what I found intriguing about this was the fact that I won't read it out, but I asked for a scene of the crime report, a DNA report, digital surveillance reports.
Yeah.
And they all gave bits and pieces of information, like the surveillance one talked about the West Wall, where he worked, cameras outside, saw him talking to a shady character. And it all gives you, I think, information to write a story.
Yes.
And bear with me, but I then thought, let's just take this one step further. So I said with this one, write me a series of reports, got the autopsy report here, about somebody, an unknown male, found in an alley with head wounds, write an autopsy report. And it goes, it gives you a number, et cetera, et cetera. And then the body is that of an unidentified male, appearing approximately 30 to 35 years of age, 170 centimetres in height and weighing about 75 kilograms. The body is well nourished with no significant signs of chronic illness. Rigor mortis is fully developed and liver mortis is fixed on the dorsal aspect of the body. There are multiple lacerations and a blunt force trauma wound to the head. The most significant wound is located on the left parietal region of the skull, measuring approximately 7 centimetres in length, with associated skull fracture and cerebral contusion. Examination of the brain after taking the scalp and removing the skull cap reveals extensive subdural hemorrhage associated with...
blunt force trauma.
That's the fella, yeah. And it goes on to talk about toxicology, cause of death, chest and abdomen. And again, it's the detail there which... As a writer, I wouldn't necessarily use in a story, but I might take some of that.
Yes, some of the... Yeah.
As a sort of, for example, about the fact that this chap is 30, 35 years of age, weighing about 75 kilograms, body's well nourished. It's giving you some background information for a character possibly there.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, one of the favourite methods of death is blunt force trauma to the brain. And liver mortis.
I think.
That's where the blood clecks.
Ah, right.
After death, and you get like purple marks, so it looks like bruising, and it's just it. You can tell from that whether somebody's been moved or not.
Okay.
See, the thing that struck me with this is that I didn't need to do any research or to have any knowledge, knowing that that was fairly accurate. Now, I'd never heard of liver mortis before until you explained it. But obviously, it's proper.
You can look that up if you needed to. I mean, one of the things with the procedures of police that I've put in my boots is things like getting search warrants or getting warrants to look at medical files. Because you can't just go in, you know. We presume that they're easy to get and they're not always... easy to get, especially when we're talking about data protection and protecting people's private details, especially if they've been ill. Yeah. In one of my books, they have to go and ask for information from a mental institute where somebody's being ill, and they want to know what their prognosis and everything, what they like now, and all this sort of thing.
And sometimes, as you imagine, that helps you in keeping the book
going.
Not so much going, but exciting. So, for example, if you were able to go to that mental institution and get that information just like that, it will quicken everything up. If actually that you're told, I'm sorry, you're going to have to come back with a search warrant and it's going to take a week, it lengthens it out. You know, you've got to go down another avenue. That avenue, which might have led to the killer's identity, is not open to you. So you're forced down another road.
Kind of balance different threads, and one of them might be moving very slowly or indeed just be stalled because you need some information that you cannot get that way, and then something else is going much quicker.
So the police all the time come against data protection issues and this sort of thing. And as we know in reality, these inquiries go on for weeks, months, sometimes years. But as a crime writer, we want it fast paced.
Yes, which is what the readers want.
Yes, they want things to happen in a very short space of time, which in reality, it doesn't sort of thing.
How important do you think hierarchy is in police procedural? Because I mean, you've got lots of different ranks all.
Yeah, I think it's all financial these days because it's so expensive to get some of these things done. And DNA doesn't come in straight away. I mean, if you fast track it, they can do DNA in like an hour if they've got nothing better to do. But like, would you prioritise and say like, well, that person's death means more than this person's death, you know? So I think the budgets are really, really tight.
I was thinking more about, you know, in terms of police rank and stuff and who can do what.
Yeah, the higher up. My chief detective in my stories, she doesn't go and ask anybody.
No.
She just asks for it to be done. And John Barron does occasionally pull in favours to get, they wouldn't be able to do that, but he pulls in favours to get results quickly. Mm-hmm.
But to some people it's important. We were watching a television programme recently, my wife and I, and I can't remember what it was about, but the detective sergeant, I think it was actually taking more of a lead, and the detective inspector seemed to be just sat there doing nothing. And at one point Anne said to me, that's not right. You know, what's actually happening now, the detective inspector would do, not the detective sergeant. Now, to me, it didn't make one iota of difference. But to her, it was important because it was out of sync.
Yeah, the SIO, the senior investigation officer, it usually is like where everything goes to. I mean, in a really big inquiry, they have to take it upstairs and say, can we have more men? Can we have more budget? Because man hours are, the police generally like, overtime, you know. But it's trying to get all that through. And I do mention that in my latest book, you know, they're all moaning because she said, you cancel everything. We're going to be looking at this. And they're all like, and her oppo says, and they weren't very happy. She said, oh, take no notice. They love the overtime. The money's wonderful. I can remember somebody I knew saying, it was during the miners' strikes. And he bought this from the overtime and he bought that from the overtime because they were sending police all over the place. You know, and he got, like a lot of the police officers did.
But as a writer of detective novels, as you are, it must be difficult sometimes getting that balance right between getting things accurate and satisfying the reader's needs. Because I suppose whenever we write, it's the reader that we should be thinking about a lot of the time.
Yeah, and I think probably I do take the odd liberty.
I think you have to.
Yeah.
I think if you didn't, then the book would get too drawn out and you'd lose anybody reading it.
So it's a bit of silent witness going on there. Well, I've been talking more than I normally do, which is, not unusual for me. But no, that's been really interesting. And thank you both for being here again today. And we'll see you all again soon. So just one thought to take away with you. Do you really know where that carving knife is that your husband was sharpening the other day? You have been listening to Only Murders in My Mind, a Random Thought production, produced by John Bissett. The music, In Peril, was composed and recorded by OM Studio Strings.